We're talking with Bill Chalker, the preeminent UFO researcher in Australia, about perhaps the one of the most important cases, the best documented UFO mass sighting, among the best in world history. In a moment, we're going to expand the conversation with other cases that Bill's been working on. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll open up the phone calls with your questions and comments from my guest. Much more to come in this coming hour of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. You know, Bill, as I hear you tell about the Westall incident, it reminds me of a case in Farmington, New Mexico, similar in that everybody in town, in this small town in New Mexico, saw these objects in the sky. But the ultimate story was sort of obscured. It didn't have the prominence it probably deserves. Would you say that Westall stands the test of time, that it would rank as one of the most important cases ever?
I think it has that, certainly has that potential. I think part of the problem, particularly given my physical science background, is that while we have evidence supporting that there was physical evidence there, ground markings, that kind of thing, and all these different witnesses, etc., there's this lack of hardcore physical documentation. Maybe that's a legacy of the heavy hand of what appears to have been a official cover-up, and also one engineered by the headmaster of the school, but it's kind of stifled that ability to get that kind of physical evidence that we would all like to have in this particular case. And that's one of the aspects, I guess, that's holding Westall back. If we could get hold of that documentation, we've certainly had, I guess, somewhat apocryphal evidence suggestive of that kind of official documentation, claims of different organisations going to the site. You know, I've had the usual kind of deep throat type sources and all that kind of stuff telling me all sorts of different versions of what took place at Westall. So it's a kind of a difficult one to unravel. It's like this gigantic jigsaw puzzle that we've still got a lot of pieces missing, but also a lot of conflicting pieces that don't seem to fit at all. So it's one of the very difficult cases, but certainly I'd agree with you. It's up there amongst them, one of the world's most interesting cases, I think. And one advantage is that a lot of the witnesses are still with us, and it occurred a lot later than Roswell.
Yes. Tell me this. You mentioned about the principal, the school folks trying to put a lid on it, and then there was some involvement of military and government entities in trying to keep a lid on it. Any indications that the U.S. military played a role in how it developed?
Well, again, that comes into the apocryphal territory. I've only sort of really had information suggestive of American involvement coming via one particular source that suggested that there was ASIO involvement, and that ASIO is our domestic intelligence service, and that person who was a relation of a ASIO officer was reportedly, well, the actual ASIO officer was reportedly requested to attend to the site, or a site in the Dandenongs, which is where the, or in that general area, related to Westall, some commotion that was taking place. It was apparently ASIO was there as a sort of a support role, mainly as containment, but they weren't. ASIO itself was not on a need-to-know basis, in that it was essentially a situation that was seemingly being controlled by Americans. But that particular version of the story seemed to suggest that it was not of an alien nature, that it was some sort of advanced kind of experimental craft that was being used as a kind of a some sort of convoluted possibility of, I think there was a series of these devices that were roaming around the world and used as sort of aerial ground or aerial stations for monitoring atomic experiments and that kind of stuff. But there was never enough detail there for us to enable a serious investigation of this, and particularly when it was all coming from one source, that kind of thing. And there are other versions or cloak and dagger versions of the story as well. Department of Supply scientists being involved, or an official within the Department of Supply being heavily involved, and so much so that it led to his early premature death, etc., because he received so much stress from what he was involved with on that day. So there's a lot of interesting elements, but unfortunately most of it seems to elude definitive resolution.
You know, the U.S., of course, has military installations, intelligence gathering operations in Australia. There are joint operations with your military, a lot of common interests there. And it seems at times over the years that the two countries speak with one voice on the UFO subject, which is to not say much. Is that an accurate assessment on my part? And do you think that is still the case?
Well, pretty much up till probably 1969, with the Convent Committee kind of report writing off the UFO subject as being of no value, courtesy of the budget that was given to them by the United States Air Force. Pretty much the Australian Air Force, the RAF, were in lockstep with, I guess, the way the American Air Force was dealing with the UFO subject, and tended to take their lead from the United States Air Force role, Project Blue Book and all that kind of thing. But once Blue Book was wound down in the wake of the Negative Content Committee report, the Australian government chose to continue their UFO investigations. They did so for another a couple of decades. So they tended to, not follow the Air Force line, although they did utilise the Condon Committee explanation that there was nothing to the UFO subject that merits serious attention. They used to trot that out regularly with their PR kind of exercises, that kind of thing. So there was a recurring element of, I guess, US policy involved with the Australian approach. But the Australians were different in the sense that we pursued it for somewhat longer, but never with the scientific vigour that I would have liked to have seen it. But there were individual scientists who were trying to get that approach, such as Professor Harry Turner, who was with the Joint Intelligence Organisation. He was trying to get up a rapid intervention team within the military government intelligence community, and had some success up to a point until he locked horns with the dynamics of government, military, and the intelligence community, which had eventually led to him being locked out of having access to the RAAF UFO files because of some criticism that he made of the way they were approaching things. So it was a bit of a mixed end result. But largely speaking, it was really the American situation that prevailed, that ultimately they grew less and less interested in the UFO subject, and eventually the Australian government wound down their interest and did so much more so in the last decade or so. Yeah.
And is that the way it really is, or do you have indications that someone within the military or intelligence circles is still monitoring it to some degree? And if so, as a corollary to that question, what are your public records laws? If there are files somewhere or somebody monitoring this stuff, are you able to access that information? I would imagine it'd be pretty tough.
Well, I did get access to the files between 82 and 84. Now, this, I should clarify, were the RAAF, Department of Defence UFO files. And over a period of 2 years, and I think over about four visits, I was able to examine a continuity of RAAF case files from about 1955 through to about 1983. And that basically showed that they were pretty much being exposed to more or less the same kind of range of cases that civilian researchers were investigating, but their kind of response to the unexplained cases was, generally speaking, to ignore them. And so they tended to have that kind of approach to it. They were really constantly trying to get out of the UFO business most of the time and to hand it off to another government department, such as the Joint Intelligence Organisation, but they didn't want a bar of it because they were a much more lower profile, largely secretive kind of intelligence organisation. The last thing they wanted to do was deal with a problem that had very uncertain public relations problems and could get them a bit more of a higher profile that they actually wanted. So it was a mixed thing, and so they tended to of stay away from that, and official interest started to finally peter out by the late 80s, early 90s.
For listeners not familiar with Bill's work, we've got links to his stuff. It's called The Oz Files, a great title. It is a link that includes many of the articles that Bill has written over the years. The last time you were here, Bill, we talked about Hera the Alien, this incredibly intricate and interesting case that you had pursued, a physical evidence case. Any updates on that? Maybe you can do a little recap of the case and tell us where things stand and whether there are any new developments.
Well, essentially that case, I think, still stands up fairly well. We got involved with that kind of like a pretty serious kind of case study of what could be achieved if we applied a sort of a fairly detailed forensic DNA focus on a case of a so-called alien abduction experience that involved a Sydney man, Peter Curry, who had a biological sample, a hair sample, and we subjected that to pretty involved DNA work. At the time when I wrote the book, Hair of the Alien, I wasn't able to identify the DNA scientist that was involved with it, but now he's come out and now retired from the CSIRO, where he worked as a principal research scientist in there. Biochemistry section, that's Dr. Horace Drew, and he's published or the co-author of one of the standard texts on DNA for a university level study, and that's Understanding DNA. So he's one of the more impressive kind of research consultants to have, and he was the primary research scientist behind doing the DNA work on Hair of the Alien. So I don't doubt the legitimacy of the results. And what essentially highlighted was it seemed to give some sustenance to the idea that it was a hybrid sample and something that wasn't readily able to be kind of produced in a prosaic kind of human sample. Now, given that it's one sample only, we would be much more comfortable if we were dealing with hundreds of samples like this. But these things, unfortunately, are fairly difficult to get hold of. But given it's given support to pursuing what I call the alien DNA paradigm, where there seems to be suggestions that a lot of indigenous cultures have had interactions with beings that may represent the same kind of beings that are behind the UFO subject today, and that they have interacted and seemingly interfered with our DNA through some form of intelligent intervention, and we're obviously pursuing angles to see whether there's any evidence of that. One of the disappointments I have with this research is that there's a lot of claims out there made by people that, even researchers that claim that they've encountered people that claim to be alien hybrids, all that kind of stuff. Now, we have the technology today, and I think this Hair of the Aliens case study that we did is a good classic example of it, that you can apply these DNA techniques and come up with some fairly interesting evidence, and yet nobody seems to pursue that that agenda that we highlighted that makes this possible. So I'm still trying to encourage people to do that. It's one thing to claim that you're an alien hybrid or that your research has highlighted evidence of alien hybrids, but I think the important thing is to get biological DNA evidence to prove it, and that's certainly what I'd like to encourage.
Yeah, if somebody's an alien hybrid, they should be able to submit a DNA sample and prove it, because, I mean, the DNA evidence would not lie.
Well, I guess the difficulty comes is what to look for, but we can certainly give a lot of people suggestions on what to look for, and there are plenty of facilities in the United States alone that would be able to do that work, and a lot more cheaply and a lot more comprehensively than we were able to do back around 2000. And now the pace of that technology has increased so astronomically and exponentially that a lot more work could be done. We'd like to see that as being a mainstay of UFO research today, particularly in the more controversial alien abduction cases. And yet we seem to be one of the more lonely examples of that kind of work being done.
So the hair of the alien. So there's an alleged alien encounter. There's a piece of physical evidence from the scene. You have it tested, and basically you're unable to identify the DNA involved.
No, we were able to identify the DNA. It appeared to be a hybrid, depending on where the you took the sample from, be it the shaft. In the shaft, it showed up as Asian mongoloid DNA in a hair sample that it should have produced a Caucasian DNA profile. And yet when we tested the root, when we retested the shaft, confirmed the earlier results, but in the root, we got evidence of what appeared to be a rare Bass Galey DNA profile. So one could argue that while the DNA in these individual samplings were not alien in themselves, what is complex and unexplainable is the fact that we had this hybrid profile. Now, skeptics who don't seem to have actually read the book or read the detail of the research don't seem to be able to understand that point, but this is one of the key points, this hybrid aspect of the sample. That's what's very difficult to explain, and it's not explainable through conventional means like heteroplasmy, which is sort of small DNA shifts. These are large DNA shifts, and so it remains a bit of a mystery. It's still a mystery as far as we're concerned, and I think an interesting template to apply to cases that perhaps seemingly are more complex, like these hybrid claims and that kind of thing. You know, it should be a routine testing technique, given today the facilities that we have more readily and more cheaply available.
Do you have any of the sample left? Could it be? I know sometimes these tests are destructive. So, is there something left to test with more advanced DNA facilities?
Very little of a viable nature to test, but we're not ruling out the possibility that there might be worthwhile testing protocols available. But at this point in time, we feel that we're better served on a wait and see approach, and rather than lose what limited sample we've got left, we'd like the we don't kind of feel that it's promising enough on the current techniques. But given the progress of techniques available today, we and in the near future, we may be in a position where further testing might lead to something further. But we feel as though, well, certainly Dr. Drew feels as though we've pushed it as far as we can on current techniques, but we'll wait and see on that one. But meanwhile, there are plenty of other cases out there that these kind of approaches would perhaps yield more interesting data that would assist comparisons with this particular case. And that's why I'm here trying to beat the drum that those sorts of claims should be addressed using DNA research techniques, and that are currently more widely, more easily and more cheaply available today. Let's see that work being done by all these different claimants that claim that they've got hybrid DNA or whatever. Let's see how it all shapes up. You know, it's really we're at that kind of crossroads with alien abduction research. We should be able to easily test that hypothesis as to whether or not people that claim they've got alien DNA, it should be easily confirmable one way or another.
Folks who are interested in this case, Hair of the Alien, it's a great story if you want to check it out, and as well as the other stuff that's on the Oz Files. In a moment, we're going to open up the phone lines with your questions and comments from my guest, Bill Chalker, about UFOs, the state of ufology, what other kind of cases he's pursuing down under, whatever is on your mind. We're talking with one of the preeminent, most experienced UFO investigators in the world, Bill Chalker, whose Oz Files blog site lists a whole bunch of papers and cases that he's worked on. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions and comments, and it's a unique opportunity to talk to one of the preeminent experts on this subject in the world. So stick around. Much more to come in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment on Coast to Coast. All right, listeners, let's show Bill Chalker. We know our stuff. We know what we're talking about. Ask some good questions. I don't know how Jeff in Culver City gets through all the time, but Jeff, you're on. How you doing?
Hey, thanks a lot, George and Mr. Chalker. How you guys doing? I once watched this film called They Live, which came out in 1998.
It's
called the late actor Roddy Piper. In this film, he was a drifter in Los Angeles who stumbled upon a box of special sunglasses. Whenever he put these sunglasses on, he could see alien beings walking amongst us. But without the glasses, you know, these aliens looked like regular people. My question is, Mr. Chaka, do you believe that our government has been involved with an alien race or subculture who have found a way to clone the image and or personality of a human, and that these entities are walking amongst us now? And also, it seems that these 21st century alien clones need constant reminders of the most basic and simplest of human functions. Like, for example, don't leave your baby in the car when it's hot. Save electricity. Turn off the light. Or save water. Turn off your sprinklers. It's almost like those signs featured in the movie They Live. I get to take your answer off there.
Yeah, well, all I can tell you is that I've never personally come across official evidence that supports all that. Certainly, there's a lot of information, stories, and other researchers that have come up with suggestions of evidence supporting that, but largely speaking, that evidence has been mainly anecdotal or derived through hypnosis, all that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty difficult area to confirm, but certainly great fodder for movies over the decades.
Well, let me ask Jeff's question in another way, Bill. What is the probability or likelihood of cloning or making a hybrid of two very different species? Can you add a dog and a cat together? Can you add monkey DNA to a pig? Is that even feasible, at least for us or any other species?
Yeah, well, see, that's coming at it from the, I guess, part of the standard kind of approach as to what aliens might be all about, and that they're possibly not even going to have DNA or anything like it, and then therefore that we couldn't mix or create a hybrid. But in reality, some of the key players in the, I guess, this DNA research field have argued to the contrary, that in actual fact, that if you wind out the DNA situation on another planet that might resemble Earth or something like that, eventually it's going to wind out and resemble something like us. And therefore, the idea that aliens being very, very different and not having compatible DNA, that kind of thing, really doesn't potentially wash. It might well be that we're a lot like them, and they're basically coming back to check out how the experiment's going, so to speak. So there's a lot of ways
you've thought about this.
yeah, it's an area that can be approached from a lot of different ways.
We're going to go west of the Rockies. Paul in Seattle. Good morning, Paul. You're on with Bill Chalker.
Good morning. Thanks a lot for taking my call, George, and good morning, Chalker. And I'd like to mention about mass sightings. Do you know anything or heard anything with your contacts about the mass sighting in Phoenix, Arizona, the Phoenix Lights in 1997? If those are flares, then that's ridiculous. But I just want to say, George, remember the Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry, the original series with William Shatner, they had transporters and all these gadgets. And now, I don't know, it wasn't too long ago they started talking about actually doing that. And so I have a theory. I think they're about 50 years ahead of us on technology, and I think Jeff's a hybrid. Okay, you guys have a great evening.
Yeah, well, actually, that caller highlighted an interesting issue, like the evidence for possible advanced technology, and that's one of the areas that I've been focusing on, particularly in the last decade. So, and that is,
really,
apart from the DNA aspect, there's this so-called solid light aspect, and I've been examining cases worldwide, getting a lot of assistance from researchers around the world in terms of trying to draw together all these international solid light cases, and the evidence for it is very, very impressive, that maybe UFOs have deployed this solid light technology, and we're just slowly starting to catch up with that kind of thing, and maybe we are only 50 years or maybe 100 years or whatever behind it, but these days, even 5 years or 10 years, there's an awful lot to catch up in. So the pace of technological change is just extrapolating, you know, and growing exponentially. So even if you're talking about 50 years difference, it's a huge difference, and almost like Stone Age to the modern age type of routine.
Yeah, 50 years from now, we might as well be a different species. And the blur of the pace of technological change, as you mentioned, he had asked about the Phoenix Lights case. I don't know if it's something you ever looked into or not.
Well, you know, obviously I have looked into it, but certainly not as much as you guys over there have looked into it. It's certainly one of those controversial cases, and government's plotted out the flare explanation, all that kind of stuff to explain the Phoenix Lights, but it doesn't seem to be an easy fit, particularly for some parts of the sightings. I'm not really the expert on Phoenix.
You know, earlier, Greg Bishop, we had talked about the idea that so many of these UFO cases through human history, dating back more than a century, it seems like the technology that's exhibited is just a little bit outside our reach, tantalizingly close to what we can do, but just a little bit outside our reach. What do you make of that?
Well, again, I guess that sort of can fit in with what I've just suggested, that there is a technological tracking going on. You know, that some people argue that it really is tracking our science fiction rather than our science fact kind of thing, that maybe solid light or tractor beams, etc., all that kind of stuff are aspects of science fiction, that kind of stuff, writ large on the UFO stage, that kind of thing. But to me, having drilled down to a number of these rather striking solid light cases, it seems to me that it's more about some sort of advanced technology that's sort of a fair way ahead of us. I think the current player, I suppose I'm not really speaking for where the military black budgets are working at the moment, because they're usually 10 years in front or whatever it is these days. But the pace of our technology in terms of something that comes closest to solid light, we've got the ability to perhaps at this point in time to be able to move something that's a microgram or something or a dust particle. We're able to not only shift it, but we can also, like the Chinese in recent times have made some advancements in being able to use analogs of solid light to be able to lift something equivalent to a dust particle. So we're still a long way from doing what seems to be suggested by a lot of UFO reports, that they're able to use solid light to pick up people, pick up vehicles, pick up whatever, and do all sorts of things. So I think we're a long way behind, and maybe I'm being optimistic talking about 50 years or 10 years or whatever, but maybe it's a lot more than that.
We're going to go to the wild card line, Henry in Sun Valley, California. Hi, Henry. You're on with Bill Chalker.
Oh, thank you, you guys. You know, I first have to say I really love your coverage of Bob Lazar. I never met the man, but United Nuclear's products helped me out a lot. Everything there is such a high-quality store. They're glow-in-the-dark stuff. They're anti-radiation pills. You know, without you telling us all about that, I would never have been able to get that high-quality merchandise for scientific teaching and all that. I want to look at this scenario like if I was a banker, all right? Interest rates, you know, banks are crazy and everything, specie money. If you look at each UFO as a type of investment that a nation could, have its people invest in, sheer fact of keeping people in the dark about this is, making people poor. And the way how I see it is you're up for about a 5 billion year investment. Because that's kind of how I figure this kind of technology is operating at, because of stars. You know, stars eat themselves. And I think what we get, you know, is these are just the holdout little tossaways of maybe something core towards the, you know, earlier parts of the galaxy, you know, stellar ejection and stuff coming our way. And, you know, if you really want to have life or even get rich, you know, you got to not think in 50 years, but really like 5 billion years, you know, 500 million megatons of helium-3 that the sun could yield. And it's all just kind of a gear in the clockwork of our natural solar system that we could be tapping into. So my overall thing is, you know, so there's the rich and there's kind of the poor. If you were to give like a dollar amount, then, you know, it's like a B2 is like $1 trillion, you know, U.S. dollars, you know what I mean? What kind of money are we really talking about? Like, are we breaking into Yoda bucks?
Yeah, I think it is in that kind of territory. You know, I think whatever is involved with UFOs, it appears to be astonishingly different, and we're just seeing tantalising differences, and we're just picking over small pieces of the evidence. And the big problem is, of course, that seldom in the civilian field do we get the opportunity to do the big bucks, the big research on, say, singular high technology type cases. And I think if we had that opportunity and a few cases to highlight it from time to time, that so much can be gathered by just investing a small amount of time, resources and that kind of thing. And I think it's a subject that's worthy of serious scientific involvement, because so much can be derived from it.
Bill, in the earlier half of I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, in the early half of the program, we talked to Greg Bishop. He's been at this a long time, not as long as you, but he theorizes that these visitors, they're certainly alien to us, but they may not necessarily be extraterrestrial. As a scientist, do you allow your mind to float off in those directions and contemplate those possibilities, or do you have to stay sort of focused?
Well, I think publicly you need to stay focused somewhat, but at the same time, one can easily speculate pretty broadly about this subject and come up with all sorts of different possibilities and position whatever you say as a theoretical rather than a factually based thing. You know, this subject highlights so many different remarkable possibilities that might be behind it all. You know, one could speculate wildly, but I tend to try and keep sort of anchored to the facts. But the facts themselves that we've been gathering for decades now seem to be tantalising enough to show us that something pretty exotic is at the heart of it. It may well be extraterrestrial, it might be something more exotic, or it could be something closer to home, but the latter I doubt. It seems to be more suggestive of something truly alien to us.
We're going to go to Joe in the Bronx. Hi, Joe. Good morning.
How are you, George?
All right.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Bill Chalker now, have there ever been any tests on recovered excretions, say salivic or perhaps blood from extraterrestrial? Have they done any genome research into what they believe is extraterrestrial DNA? And the Bible says that we were all created in God's image. Well, if that's the case, then whose image were the aliens created in?
Well,
that's a lot to chew
like
on.
Us, but maybe our future or our past, who knows? But yeah, there has been DNA evidence, and I wrote a whole book on it. So, but in terms of saliva and blood, no, not to my knowledge. But there are plenty of cases out there and various experiences that are claimed that suggest that if that kind of evidence is available. And I'd love to see that being studied utilizing advanced DNA techniques, but that seems to be pretty slow in the uptake, as far as I can see. You know, we seem to be one of the few case studies that have done that.
As I mentioned a little bit ago, Bill has an excellent book, Hair of the Alien, in which it might be the only DNA sample of a suspected alien piece, tidbit, that's ever been done, and it's a fascinating exploration.
Well, at least in public circles, anyway.
Yes, in public, right, yeah. Anyway, so check that out if you get a chance. We got links to Bill's work on the Coast to Coast AM website. First-time caller, John in Dana Point. Hi, John.
Hi, George and Bill. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about disclosure. What do you think the advantage of having disclosure would actually be? I'm 66, and since I was 18, I've seen four different craft, all within a quarter of a mile, two during the day and two at night. I'm a pilot, and I've flown a lot at night up and down the coast and through the desert. I've never seen any lights, but I have seen the craft. So if a government would declare disclosure, and they would try to open up and tell us the truth, not that we could believe it, but what would the advantage be? Do you think it would turn into like a witch hunt for the people that have had some kind of experience, or what do you think the situation around the world would be?
Well, let's ask Bill. I mean, I don't know where you are on the disclosure thing, Bill, if it gets as much attention in Australia as it does here, but a lot of discussion, especially in light of the presidential campaign Hillary Clinton and both and her campaign manager have both made statements about UFOs, and if they get in office, they would find and release whatever files are releasable. And I don't know if the same kind of discussions are underway in your country or thoughts you have given to how disclosure would roll out and what the ramifications would be, but go ahead and give it a shot.
I suppose I'm coming at it from, I guess, decades of research and probably from a more jaded kind of perspective, in the sense that, frankly, I'm not that keen to wait for disclosure. I'd rather directly engage with the phenomenon and do the research and the hard yards that are required, rather than beat around the bush and wait for the government to, come to the party, so to speak, and be more open about what they've been doing about this subject. But from my own limited perspective, what I've seen of our own government here, they've been pretty much doing pretty much what civilian researchers have been doing, perhaps with a bit more in the way of focused resources. But really, I don't see much evidence of real scientific investigations by our Australian government into the subject. But maybe that's occurring at a more black project type level. But I haven't seen any serious evidence of that either. But so, I'm happy to proceed on a civilian basis, not worry about disclosure. When it does happen, if it ever does happen, so be it. But I don't think it's going to, shake things up too much. I guess it really depends on the individual. Some people might get a hell of a wake-up call, who knows, and a lot of skeptics out there and debunkers might get a bit of a shake-up, that kind of thing, and religions perhaps, but who knows. But to me, it's just an academic catch-up exercise with disclosure. I'm not waiting anytime soon for disclosure.
No, don't hold your breath. And I guess it also depend on what exactly they disclose. If they say aliens are here, we don't have anything to worry about, they've been here a long time, that's one thing. If they say they're here to eat us, that's another.
Oh, yeah, well, I think obviously if we're part of the menu and that kind of stuff, it's something to truly worry about. And if the government starts confirming it, I think there'll be a lot of people out there wondering whether it's a joke or not. But,
Bill Chalker, it's always great to talk to you. I encourage people to check out your stuff, the Oz Files. We've got links on the Coast to Coast website. I hope you'll keep us in mind when you got some interesting cases going on and come back and join us. And I hope someday I get to come down there and visit again, and or perhaps that you can come and visit us.
Yep. Well, I always like talking to you, George. So, yeah, I look forward to that possibility.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it, Bill Chalker. And hope folks will check out his Hair of the Alien and other publications as well. Thanks also to Greg Bishop, my earlier guest, whose book is an excellent read. It Defies Language, it's called. Thanks to my colleagues there at Coast, Jeff DeRay, G. Lee, Dan Galati, our webmaster tonight, Lex Lonehood, and our producer, Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp, and I'll be back next Sunday. Good night, everyone.